Hello, everyone. Ruby Ryder here. Welcome to Begging Paradise podcast number 200 on May 22nd, 2018. So here we are, podcast number 200, and still changing the world, one ass at a time. So I wanted to make a quick mention that the Patreon has been happening, but I'm going to save all that for the next podcast. So I just want to all you people who have signed up to be patrons, just a quick thank you. You'll get mentioned in the next podcast. So here's the deal. One thing I have absolutely learned from having done 200 podcasts is that in the world of podcasts, anything can happen. I find it somewhat frustrating and somewhat amusing that the universe threw me a couple of curves for my 200th podcast. It feels kind of fitting in a way. I mean, no matter what in podcast land, you just have to persevere. So here I am. This podcast is a marathon, just like I did for the 100th podcast. You have got three full podcasts to listen to. Woohoo! So what are they? The first two are an interview with my good friend Michelle, and the last one is her boyfriend Paul. Michelle and I talk about cuddling, connections, emotions, vulnerability, relationships, and so many related topics that are all actually incredibly important to not only be thinking about, but even more important to be talking about. Paul and I continue this conversation. We talk about similar things, and he shares openly about his own journey, seeking what was missing from his life. We talk about connecting with others, reaching out to people, vulnerability, raising kids, and again, so much more. So here's the completely and totally awesome thing about this podcast. You have three people who have done a pretty serious amount of work on themselves, offering up not only what we think is valuable and found in the world to be valuable for us, but with all the links to seek out whatever resonates with you. At the end of all these podcasts, I'm going to do a recap of the links, and I encourage you to explore whatever calls to you at your leisure. There is going to be so much good information in the Linkorama for this 200th podcast. And in a way, Paul, Michelle, and I are basically doing our part to spread the word and get conversations going in the hopes of more people finding happiness, connection, and love. So before I start, what were the two curves that got thrown at me? Well, I'm interviewing two people. With Michelle, I had my speakers up too loud, so you're going to hear a little bit of echoing now and again. And I tried to edit most of it out, and I did a pretty good job, but there you go. With Paul, unfortunately, my really good microphone was not picking it up, and I didn't notice, and it was a desk microphone that was picking it up. So my voice is going to sound a little bit like I'm in a room with people in the background, and I absolutely wasn't, I swear to you. But those are the two curves that got thrown at me. I think that you're going to enjoy all three of these podcasts nonetheless, but I wanted to warn you that sound quality is not up to its usual standards in Pegging Paradise Land, and I do apologize for that. So let's get on with the podcast here. I want to go back to podcast number 188 and read you something for the second time that I found on Facebook. It was written by Kate Lurie, and it was in response to one of the seemingly endless shootings at a school. A devil's deal is made with our white boys in the U.S. at a very young age. It goes like this. Number one, you will not be allowed to express yourself emotionally. Number two, you will not be able to express yourself sexually beyond heteronormative ideals. Number three, you will not be able to express yourself creatively through dress or dance. In other words, you will sell your soul, or at least part of your humanity. Note, violations to the contract will be seen as feminine or gay and will be punished. But in exchange, number one, you will be able to dominate others with little recourse. Number two, you will be allowed to be entitled in most areas of your life. Number three, white males who look like you and started our country via genocide and enslavement will be seen as heroes rather than deeply sociopathic. This is not a good deal, but it is foisted upon our innocent, lively, creative, emotional boys. It's a recipe for a spiritual breakdown. And then we wonder why our schools continue to get shot up by white boys. We wonder why white male politicians violate our basic human rights and allow shootings to continue. A baby boy is born full of light and promise. He's born with all the potential for kindness and compassion in the world. But this is what we do to this baby boy. If emotional intelligence and compassion is likened to a sword that one can wield, then how is this boy to master the sword if he is punished for even picking it up? We give him this devil's deal at a very young age. It's foisted upon him by the church, family, peers, coaches, and advertising. Very few men truly find a way to dodge this fate. Just watch the mask you live in if you don't believe me. The lucky ones who were not assimilated somehow have had access to alternative enculturation while being shielded from the brainwashing. So what's the solution? Obviously, changes need to occur at the top, the NRA, etc. But it also needs to start with our young boys who are under an emotional pressure cooker with little outlet for healthy, emotional, sexual, or creative expression, while concurrently being allowed to be self-entitled. This cultural shaping is bound to create some sociopaths who may grow up to be a shooter, a narcissistic CEO, or a heartless politician. Strength is not a male trait. It's a human trait. Compassion is not a female trait. It's a human trait. If we begin to break down these gender norms that suffocate human authenticity and potential, I promise you, rape and mass shootings will decrease. Love, tolerance, and harmony will finally ascend and take a proper place within humanity. So this is the writing that got me walking down this path. Kate Lurie is an LMFT, licensed marriage and family therapist, and she handles both dating singles and married couples. She specializes in alternative sexuality issues for those who are curious about realms outside of monogamy, polyamory, kink, BDSM, and swing lifestyles. She also specializes in porn stars, escorts, sex workers, along with those who love them, and she does offer Skype sessions. So I watched the movie. I watched that movie, The Mask You Live In, and it started me off down this path of questioning the gender norms that society feeds us, the gender norms that many of us have grown up with and continue to persist and are incredibly toxic. They do a lot of damage to everyone, not just the men that she speaks of. It affects our entire society. So I wanted to have a conversation about that with some people that I felt had some valuable things to say. So from that, talking about touch, connecting, and being authentic, and being in relationship with others, I'm going to play the interview with Michelle. So for my 200th podcast, what I decided to do is to do a podcast about touch. Touch has been a really central thing in my life. I've been a massage therapist for 28 years and counting. You know, you lovely patrons out there are giving me money so that I can stop doing massage, and I love you for that because it's time. But what that has done for me is made me really, really aware of touch. And as I've gone further in my life and explored other things and now find myself as this teacher all about strap-on pegging stuff, I find that touch, again, is a huge factor, a really, really big factor. And specifically, touch in the ways that society does or does not allow us to experience different kinds of touch depending on our gender. I'd like to welcome Michelle Renee to the podcast. You might remember Michelle either from her interview with me after her very first pegging experience, and then not too long after that, her interview with me, which had great fame about the pegging gangbang. So, Michelle, welcome. And the reason I wanted to invite you here is because you are very much about touch. So what I want to know, Michelle, is kind of an overview about what you do with cuddling. I mean, clearly it's all about touch, but how does that figure into, well, all kinds of things? You know, who comes to you? What do they struggle with? What do you do for them? How does it work?
Well, first of all, I would say it's not about touch. Touch oversimplifies it. They're looking for connection. They're looking for human connection, human contact, that nurturing, mutual enjoyment. So, I see a whole range of people for lots of different things. I don't know if there's one commonality between everyone, but for sure it's that if they enjoy it, it's probably because they've lacked that closeness. And I say that like an intimacy. What I offer is platonic. Mm-hmm. It is, I won't say it's non-sexual because certainly it generally comes into the room at some point and we have to discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest question I get, you know, most of my clients are male. And so one of the big questions is, well, what happens if I get an erection? And erections are perfectly normal. And I was watching a TED talk with Emily Nagasse recently about unwanted arousal. Erections don't mean necessarily that you're sexually aroused. Your nervous system is aroused in some fashion, but it doesn't mean anything. And even if it does mean something, it doesn't mean we have to act on it. And
right.
So we can keep a platonic session. Maybe we have to take a break. Maybe we have to do something to distract. It's not going to offend me. It's certainly not going to end a session.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you know, are an adult and you behave yourself and follow our agreements, it's not a problem at all. So most of my clients ask that question. And then the other question is like, well, how much clothing are we going to wear?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a clothing policy. The minimum is shorts and a tank top. And a lot of that is just to remind ourselves that this is non-sexual. And I know that skin feels really, really great. And there is skin that is certainly available for caressing. You know, my shoulders, I'm generally in a tank top. Like there's access. But it doesn't have to be full on body to feel that beautiful sensual touch that we can share with each other. Because it's sensual, it's not going to be sexual. We're not going to have any genital touching. We're not going for arousal. It's, you know, I used to joke when I first got started, I used to joke that I was in the business of professional tease and denial. and
although that's funny, it's not the right way to put it.
It's not, but at the time I did see it that way. I was taking a lot of clients that were coming to me because they couldn't get what they really wanted and they would settle, you know, to see how much access to me that they could get. At least that's my view on it in retrospect.
They were pushing the boundaries then.
Well, they're looking to see how far they could go. It used to be a thing like if you gave an inch, they'd take a mile. And I learned that really quick in the business. I've been doing this since. Actually, I did training for Cuddlist. I became certified right after or right before we recorded my first podcast with you. So it's been like 3 years.
Uh-huh.
Or 2.5 years. I don't know. What was that? 2015. December 2015. So I've been doing the cuddling thing for a little while. And I've come to a lot better understanding. The ones that it does feel like tease and denial, that's exactly what they want it to be. And that's not a cuddlist session.
No, that's like a foreplay session.
Yeah, and there is space for that in the world for sure. I think what is more important for me is that they're honest with what they want. If they're looking for a cuddlist certified platonic cuddling session, that's one thing. But what they're doing by wanting the tease and denial is a different service. That's not a cuddlist service.
Yeah, let's dive into that a little bit, though, because of the whole thing of men being touch-starved in our society. Mark Green has done a lot of work on that, and I'll have a bunch of links in the Linkorama for you guys. Written a lot of articles about it and recently came out with a new book. And the basic premise behind a lot of his work is that at that certain age, men are deprived of tender, non-sexual, loving touch, and it becomes something that they're not supposed to need or have. And so you get to a point where, okay, flash forward, and here we have an adult man coming to you for a cuddling session. how can they be clear about what they want if they have never learned to differentiate between the two?
Sure. And I guess that's where I have to ask the question of, are you seeking a non-sexual service? Because if they aren't seeking it, then I can't provide it. Do you know what I mean? Like, if they really want to push themselves and experience it, I can hold those boundaries and I can hold them really well.
Yeah.
And we can overcome the sexual connection, the tying, the closeness to sex, because we're all nuzzled in together and it does feel very couple-ish. You know, we're sharing an hour. I like to say that, you know, they let me love them for an hour. I'm putting my whole heart into it. I don't care who you are that shows up. The people that tend to try a session, I connect with them. I always find a way to connect with my clients. Like, it may not be the way they want to connect because they come in and they really struggle around the, can I cuddle with you if I'm attracted to you? Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, we can overcome that together. It's okay to be attracted to me, and it's okay for me to be attracted to my client. Isn't that lovely that we can put that aside and enjoy each other and not let the sexual energy get in the way?
It's like the walls coming down. I love how you express that. They let me love them for an hour. I love that.
Yeah.
It's like the walls need to come down for them to allow that emotional sensitivity, that emotional connection, and their walls that have to be up by society's dictating almost all the time when you're a man, if you've been raised regularly and that kind of stuff. I know that you had mentioned to me at one point in time that you were glad that you had raised your two boys homeschooling. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, I have two sons. One is 20 years old and one is 12. And they didn't get, I don't know what the right term is I want to use without, you know, pissing somebody off, but I want to say, like, they didn't get infected by assholery or like, I have, you know, they're really emotionally, they have more emotions than just anger.
Hmm.
You know, they have a full spectrum of emotions and they're not afraid to share them with me. Like, and that may be a partly a benefit from my divorce is that they get me to themselves.
Hmm.
And so I'm very emotionally open with them. I don't hide when I'm upset. I don't hide when I'm crying. I've been always very open about the fact that, yeah, I cry when I'm happy and I cry when I'm sad. And like, I have a full range of emotions too. And they've witnessed those and they share theirs with me. Like, it's not uncommon to, you know, I travel a lot. I'm in Southern California a lot, and I'm in Michigan a lot. And my kids are in Michigan. And it's not uncommon to get a phone call from my 20-year-old where he wants to talk something through with me. And you can tell he's upset about it to the point of eventually he may cry with me. And I don't shame him for that. Like, I cry with him because that's just, you know me, that's how I roll. But
yeah, you cry.
I'm so happy. Yeah, I'm a crier. And I'm so happy that, you know, they don't hide that. Like, at least not for me.
And, well, and that's a beautiful thing that you hold that space for them. That is the safe space for them to have their emotions. And that's one of the things with what I do with the whole pegging thing that I hear echoed a bit. And that's why all of these things kind of tie in together. They're like fingers interweaving. That's why I wanted to talk with you about this on this podcast, because what I get from couples is thankfulness that the man has a safe space. He finds in his partner a safe space to where he can let go. He can be emotional. He can allow her to penetrate him. He can do things that normally would be considered weak if he has a partner who really holds that space and welcomes it and dives into the whole pegging experience with him. It's such a gift. And I think the reason that it is such a gift, to the point where people write me letters, it's really something, you know, for everybody who writes in, you know, there's a bunch who never sit down and take the time to write. And they talk about that so much, how profound it feels. And I think it feels profound because finally they're given a safe space.
They're given a safe space and they're given permission.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you can create the container, but still, if you kind of step back and you're not really into the whole thing and maybe there's a little judge energy, that's not good.
No, that's the same thing with my work. I remember my boss and my mentor, the creator of the training with for Cuddlist, Madeline Guanazzo, said to me one time, you can't be tolerating your clients. They're not going to get a benefit from you if that's the case.
Yeah.
And I called you and I said, Ruby, I think I have to fire a couple of people. and I did. I fired one or two people. Because I realized every time they called me, my eyes were rolling. And I was like, ugh. And they're not going to get the experience they're looking for if I'm not in it with my whole heart. And that's the same thing with your partner. If they're not genuinely showing up and having a real desire to meet you where you are, then it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm. What's some of the most rewarding experiences that you've had as a Cuddlist?
Oh, gosh. There was the man that saw me, a couple of months after his wife had passed away. It makes me choke up now.
Yeah, I can hear it.
He saw a lot of his wife in me. And I was able to help him probably get a little closure. I don't know, but it was a lovely, it's one of those sessions that you just know that you were given a place to make a big impact in his life. I'm sure, he's on my Facebook. I still hear from him. That's a common theme for me. I lost my mom 15 years ago. And I think that some of my favorite clients generally have that shared history with me. And I can't say that I lost a spouse, and I know that it's not the same, but it's certainly as close as I can get. And I recently had a client that had lost his spouse about 9 months earlier. And he came to me because he saw my ad on Craigslist back before Sesta and Fosta, took down one of my major advertising sources. He saw my ad on Craigslist, and I used to advertise for human connection is how I would word it.
Nice.
And it spoke to him, and he thought, that's what I'm missing right now in my life. And he came to me, and we had a really lovely heart-to-heart, and he talked about his, not knowing if he was ready to date again, but really missing this in his life. And we just got to talk about how he was starting to understand that she really wasn't coming back. And he opened up to me so quickly. And how does that happen? It happens because we're holding each other.
Yes.
At least that's what I believe. There's something that lets your guard down when you're touching. And it may just be sitting at a table and holding hands across the table with a friend or touching knees. A lot of times, Paul, my partner, Paul, that I always talk about on your show, I'll just tap my foot under the table. It's such a reassuring feeling. And so when my clients come in and they realize how quickly they warm up to me and they're a little baffled by it, but it makes sense. We're holding each other and I'm very non-judgmental. And I make them feel comfortable and safe. And so they share with me all sorts of things. And so those are my favorite ones, is the ones that are going through some kind of big life transition. And then there's just people that just need to feel seen and heard for a little while. There's nothing big going on,
Yeah. When I was starting to look into the cuddling thing and starting to go to cuddle parties, and right around then I'd already been to a number of cuddle parties, and I was going to say, I'll change it to, and it was with a group that was all about sex positivity. And there seemed to be, the cuddle parties were lovely because they had a way of rating them for different levels of interaction because they were a sex positive group. So they were eventually about sex, but you could go to to the number one level and have a completely platonic experience like a Cuddlist session might be, except if, it's a cuddle party. So it's not a session.
Well, let me correct you, Ruby. Cuddle Party is a very specific brand that is always platonic. Yes. So we like to say snuggle parties or cuddling parties, something that's not actual, because I'm a cuddle party facilitator and it is definitely a non-sexual event. So
Yes, and that is a brand name, and I forget that because that's really, really important. And the Cuddle Party people have been around for a long time, and they've always been non-sexual and platonic. So I would go, what I decided to call them, once you straightened me out on that, and thanks for doing it again, is I call them cuddle gatherings, you know? And, you know, I'd been to some of those, and the connectedness at those gatherings was pretty amazing. I mean, I wouldn't know some of those people if they were walking down the street at the same time. I can vividly describe to you what it felt like. I mean, one of the first gatherings that I went to was facilitated by Jean Fransblau. And one of the things that she did in the very beginning part of it, you know, she taught us all about holding that container, about being authentic, all the things that normally happen at the beginning of these gatherings. And then she said, okay, so before we start, I just want to go around the circle one more time, and I want to hear what's your mild and what's your wild. And here's what I mean by that. You know, you came to this cuddle thing. So what's sort of the most mild thing that you had in your mind that might happen? You know, and even if you just wanted to sit on the couch and watch people, that's fine too. And then I want to hear what's the wildest thing within the boundaries that we've already discussed, right? So my mild was somebody sitting behind me and playing with my hair or something like that. And my wild was doing one of those cuddles where you are face to face and your leg is in between their legs and you're intertwined and you're just wrapped around each other. For me, it's a normal position like after sex. And that was my wild, right? And the cool thing about doing that at this gathering, it was brilliant of Jean, was that you got to hear people's wild. And so you could actually remember, hey, that person wanted to do that. And you could go over and offer that to them if it's something that you wanted. So there I was cuddling this guy who was probably 2/3 as tall as me. He was a short guy, and we were cuddling, doing spooning. And then all of a sudden, he kind of leans back. We kept switching, turning, so big spoon, little spoon, you know. And finally, he goes, would you like to do your wild? It was just this delicious moment. And I'm like, yeah.
It's very physically vulnerable, though.
Yes, it is. That heart-to-heart thing. It totally is.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So part of what happens, too, with this whole touching thing is when I got interested in all of this, I got on Facebook and I said, okay, I have a question for everybody. Are you getting as much non-sexual, tender, loving touch as you need? And I'm not sure I used all of those words. I may have just said non-sexual touch. And the second question that I posed was, do you have a partner? Mm-hmm. And I was frankly blown away by how many people had partners and were not getting as much non-sexual touch as they wanted. And it's not just women. I think there might be a tendency for people to jump to that conclusion and sort of assume that the men are jumping into sexual all the time and so the women aren't getting enough. But when I started really exploring some of these things about how men are raised and that kind of thing and reading the Mark Green articles about how the vast majority of men in our society are touch-starved, oh, when I started talking about that, the guys were coming out of the woodwork going, yeah, I would give anything just for some touch. You know, I just get so little of it on a daily basis.
Yeah. Oh, do I know that? Yeah, I mean, how many people, I was in therapy in my 20s. After my mom passed away, I reached out to her therapist because I needed something that felt familiar, and I was dealing with a lot of grief.
Mm.
And I didn't go to him for long, but how nice to know that I could go to my mother's therapist, and I didn't have to explain who she was.
Mm.
And I was dealing with, you know, my marriage at that point. I wanted out every 6 months. And I've been married since I was like 20, 21, something like that.
Uh-huh.
So I went to him and, you know, inevitably stopped talking about my mother and started talking about my marriage. And he said, well, why are you married? And I'm like, well, you know, you're supposed to be married because you love somebody. And I didn't know if I loved my husband at that point. And he said, well, people stay married for all sorts of reasons. And at 27 years old, I couldn't fathom that.
Wow.
At 42 years old, you know, I can totally fathom that because I did it for a chunk of my 30s.
Mm-hmm.
People are married for all sorts of reasons, and we could judge them for staying in something that isn't ideal, but they're there, and there's a way that they can get those needs met. Unfortunately, they can't do it probably consensually with their partner, because their partner doesn't understand that they have those needs.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the people I see are married. I'm probably safer than a girlfriend, and when their wives find out, I haven't had it happen to me, but I know other professional cuddlers that have, then they generally have to break off the business relationship with their professional. But
wow, and they're just coming for touch. And, you know, when you say marriage, and it doesn't have to be a marriage, and that's why I posed the question the way that I did, partner. And it's also interesting because, of course, my assumption is that if you have a partner, quote unquote, well, again, you know, partner can mean all different kinds of things. And my assumption, of course, would be, and it's because that's what I want, is someone who really fulfills that need of mine for as much touch as I need, or, you know, certainly makes quite a big dent in it. And perhaps I can get other touch from other people. But again, even if it's just a partner or a partner that you're married to, that's not what everybody wants.
Oh, I'm having a brain flash here.
Okay.
Think about love languages. So physical touch is a love language. Okay. So you meet.
Okay. So wait, I just want to tell people what we're talking about here. There's a book called The Five Love Languages, and it's by
Gary Chapman, I believe.
Thank you. And the five love languages are quality time, acts of service, touch, communication, and gifts. Am I correct?
Well, instead of communication, words of affirmation.
Words of affirmation. Okay.
Yeah.
So now go ahead.
So now think about, I'm just going to go back to my case. So let's say you meet when you're young and you haven't had a lot of relationship experience, and maybe you've never heard of the five love languages.
Mm-hmm.
And you get with a person and, you know, everything's new. And so you're having a lot of sex. And so you're getting a lot of that physical touch that you need. Mm-hmm. But what happens when your sex life slows down? Because, you know, you get past that new relationship energy and you're settled into your relationship, and maybe somebody doesn't make it a priority, or you're not asking for what you need, or whatever, for whatever reason, the sex slows down.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe your partner isn't a physical touch love language person.
Yeah.
And maybe touch bothers them. So they're like, don't touch me. Maybe they're a mom that stays home with the kids, or a dad that stays home with the kids, and they're touched out. Like, there's so many reasons that people don't get those needs met.
Yeah, there's so many different reasons. My gosh. And there is a place online where you can go and take a test to figure out what your love languages are. And I have found it to be so helpful, not just for understanding myself, even though the results that I got on the test were pretty much what I expected, but even something as simple as, not simple, unexpected, something as unexpected as knowing my daughter better.
Mm.
Her top love language is gifts. So when I really want to show that I love her, I'll just buy her a little something. And oh my gosh, the glee on her face.
Yeah, I say that I'm fluid in all five love languages. I speak them all very, very thoroughly. You can ask Paul. and what's funny about that is I also receive all of them really well, too. And I notice that if I retake the test, I can tell what I'm lacking in because it moves to the top.
Interesting.
So mine don't stay really stagnant. Like, they're very flexible. And I really think that I'm one of those people that needs all of them. Like, I need a little bit from all the different dishes on the buffet of love languages. And yeah, it makes it a little difficult.
There's a way that you are just so open that being fluid and skilled in all the love languages, that doesn't surprise me, because you have an openness and a vulnerability that very few people have, because I can only imagine it's really difficult to walk around in the world that vulnerable and open.
It's easier than that for me. I don't know. I mean, I think I mentioned when I was married, I couldn't live authentically. Maybe that wasn't in this conversation, but I was miserable. I dealt with depression. It was difficult. My partner didn't want me. He had an idea of who I was and who I should be, and I needed to fit that mold. And I remember when I first started dating Paul, I would do something I think obnoxious. I'm a sex geek and I'm a pervert, and like I kind of say things that make people like pick their jaw up off the table or something. And I remember being at a party with Paul, and I made some ridiculous comment. And I immediately turned and looked at him, waiting for that disapproving glare that I used to get from my husband.
Wow.
And he was just like, ha ha ha, you're so fun. And it took a while before I really trusted that he just loves me the way I am. And I get to be extremely vulnerable with him, and he is learning to open up more and more to me. And it's really, to think that it all started over some pegging. it makes total sense. That's, you know,
well, yeah.
he was vulnerable with me from the first date. So like, I'm not surprised, but I don't know any other way to be. I think it's harder to be locked up for me. So
it's pros and cons. And I don't mean that one's better or the other. I think it's a personal battle. This is how I picture it anyway. I picture it as a personal battle in terms of wanting to walk around and be authentic. Talking to all these guys in my pegging empire, so to speak, I hear them so often talk about, I wish that I could do this. I wish I could walk around and wear skirts. I wish that I could wear panties underneath my clothes. I wish that I could just sort of collapse and be held and be comforted sometimes. But society and or their partners don't allow that. So they have these cravings. They really want to be. But then the other part of the battle is that that's what happens. The societal crap.
I have a lot of privilege. I have so much privilege. I have the privilege of being female.
Mm-hmm.
I have the privilege of being self-employed.
Mm-hmm.
I made a conscious decision when I started sexaftermarriage.org, my blog that I kind of walked through this, you know, reentering the dating life and exploring, you know, all sorts of sexuality and relationship styles and whatnot. I made a choice when I started that blog, and our friend Keith designed it for me. And when I first looked at it and I saw like my boudoir pictures on it, and I don't know how comfortable I am putting this out. And I went, well, Michelle, you're never going to work for anybody else if you do this. And it kind of like guaranteed that I would never hold a regular job after that point. And so I've already made that decision that I'm going to live my life authentically.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever those ramifications are, I assume that they're going to guide me to even be more authentic and to my true path. And so that's where I've ended up. I mean, that's how I've ended up here. I have the privilege. Now, if you're, you know, Joe Smith working in corporate America, you've got a lot of different obstacles to that. So like, it's not going to be easy, but I wish that it could be easy with your partner.
I totally agree with you in terms of I feel the same way. I am very privileged as well. I'm a female, and you know, female. A long time ago, I read a book called "The Men We Never Knew," I think, and it's quite dated at this point. But the author was talking about this exact concept of not really allowing men to have their emotions, and perhaps wasn't, you know, so succinctly expressing it. But one of the concepts that she put forth was that we're pretty much, as females, given carte blanche with our emotions. And men are expected to put their emotions aside and kind of hold space for ours. That's sort of what they're expected to do. And how that is never expected in the opposite direction. And I came face to face with that. It blew my mind because I was raised that way with those things happening around me, just like I said. And then I had a boyfriend and his mom died. And I wanted to be there for him. I wanted to hold that space for him. And he was having a really tough time with it. And I felt inside myself, because one of the things that was happening was something happening in our relationship that was really difficult for me. It had nothing to do with the mom thing, but I felt inside myself in this moment, I really wanted to talk about that because I was really upset about that. And I knew the mom thing was up for him. And I had to literally, and probably only because I read that book, I had to literally squelch it and say, this is not the time. Your emotions are not more important than his. You need to just be here and hold space for this man who just lost his mom. And that's exactly what I did. But I see that happen unsuccessfully. I see women's emotions trumping, you know, men's all the time. And also, women don't usually have the skill to put theirs aside and hold space for the men. It's different when, like, you in your profession with Cuddlist. I mean, you're not in a relationship with that person, but that's what you do, is put your stuff aside and you're just 100% there for them the entire time. And how often do people get that? No wonder people pay you for this.
Well, I mean, and fortunately, we've drawn a lot of people to Cuddlist for training that are very like-minded. And so we are all doing our own work, because that's really an important quality to be successful in what we do, is to really be working on ourselves too all the time. We're all showing up kind of as peers, and not, I'm not better at this than my client is. It's just that I'm a couple steps ahead. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just a couple steps ahead in the journey. And so I get to, like, I've learned things. So I've learned that there is a lot of help in just listening. I don't have to solve my client's problems. And so when they want to talk to me, or maybe they don't want to talk to me, we can sit in silence too. But if they want to talk to me, just being able to listen to them and help them co-regulate, which is a term that I like to throw out there. It's this idea that to regulate yourself, to self-regulate, is like to control your emotions and to soothe yourself. And by co-regulating, I get to help soothe my partner. And they have the answers they need. So if I can just listen to them and give them a space to work that out for themselves, they'll come to the conclusion that they need. I don't have to fix anything. So by being a calm presence for them, it helps calm them down. It helps, we can breathe together. Like, I have a way of kind of, without somebody knowing, kind of taking over their breathing patterns. So I can slow them down and help them relax. And when their nervous system relaxes and then they can talk about it, they come up with their own conclusions. They know how to solve their own problems. It's just having a place.
That takes me back to a memory of a good friend of mine. She's my backpacking friend. And I lived with her for a short period of time. Her kids were 5 and 7, and my daughter was 1 year old. So we all lived together. And she was reading some parenting books at the time. And one of the parenting books that she read talked about not having to feel like you need to fix your kids' problems. And so... And very much like in the way you say, just holding space for them. So I'll never forget. It's like, I wasn't there, but she related this conversation to me. Her son comes home and he was talking about this thing at the school that happened and this girl that was mean and stole something out of his lunch and this kind of thing. And she wanted to, you know, save him. She wanted to call the school. She wanted to, talk to the parents. You had all these urges because you want to protect your kid, you know? And she just kept saying, wow, that sounds difficult. And just mirroring it back and holding that space and listening. He said, yeah, she's not very nice. I'm going to stay away from her from now on. And he just walked away and he was fine. And so sometimes just holding that space and listening is so important. So important.
Yeah, people just want to be seen and heard. But it's like, two basic requirements. They just want to know that somebody sees them. It's just, when I was in cuddle party facilitator training, that was part of our training, was kind of like, when you get somebody who's nervous about coming to your party, a lot of times they'll send you a lot of emails. And it helped me in previous times. When I was married, we had our own business, and so I dealt with a lot of customers. But in replying to emails, it's like, the sooner you can make them feel seen and heard, the sooner they'll feel safe that you're going to be able to see and hear them in your event or whatever, they relax. and the questions stop because they know that they trust that you're going to be able to do that again.
Hmm.
So the faster you can kind of do that with someone, and it's just that simple. It's just not trying to fix them, but just being like empathy, like that must be really rough.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, just, it's just that same, it's all you have to do. It's so simple. And if you do that with your partner, like not react, don't, like, that's safety. Like, I want my partner to know that they can tell me anything and I'm not going to react.
Mm-hmm.
I will have a reaction at some point, trust me. but my goal is to not react in the moment and take some time to process it and figure out what my role is and how do I feel about it and then take it back to them. My goal is never to make them feel like they can't talk to me because I'm going to be too upset or too angry or something.
So you are consciously sort of putting your emotions aside and holding that space, and in effect, because, you know, mm-hmm. this is a really good description of it, helping them co-regulate whatever they're going through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's emotional intelligence. It's a lot of maturity. It's something I couldn't do when I was younger. You know, it's just something that it's a skill that you learn and you put in your toolbox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that because of what society does to men, total generalization, but the whole emotional hobbling of them, they're really used to putting those emotions aside. They're not so used to just listening and not trying to fix. But I think the sad part for me comes when you want those emotions to come out. And sometimes mm-hmm. it's so difficult. Well, why is it difficult? Because there's so much reinforcement everywhere you turn that is not how they're supposed to be. And it's so counter to what's really healthy in a relationship, mm-hmm. that emotional connection. And no wonder it's so difficult in a relationship to have that emotional connection when men have been taught since they were little that you don't have emotions, the stoicism, you know?
Yeah, they file them away. I don't even think they acknowledge them to themselves. Like, it's not like they're going, wow, I really feel this way, I'm just going to tuck that aside. They bypass that step. They don't even feel them.
Yes.
They're just completely ignored. And then you end up with anger because that's the only thing they're allowed to express.
And that's the saddest thing. And sometimes they direct it inward and sometimes they direct it outward. Mm-hmm. There's a woman I knew when I was much younger. She and I were talking and she was talking about trying to get her husband to tune in a little bit more about his own emotions. And he said, look, I'm doing really, really well to be able to tell you I'm having emotions. You know, to know what they are, I don't have a clue yet. She related a comedy piece that this guy did, and he talked about, okay, so, you know, all you women out there, you want us to be emotional, you want us to soften up a little bit, you know, you want to talk about emotions. He said, so, you know, women, it's like they have this big bag that they carry around and they have all their emotions in it. And you say, how are you feeling? And they take one out and they tell you how they're feeling. And they have so many different words to describe how they're feeling. Mm-hmm. If you're a man and somebody says, so how are you feeling right now? You have to get on your donkey. You have to go all the way up the mountain, up the top, down to the other side, into the canyon. You have to find the emotion first. And then on the long trip back, all the way up to the top of the mountain and back down, you have to figure out what it is.
Yeah, I asked my partner the other night, because we were doing the pillow talk, you know, the vulnerable after sex pillow talk. And I said, and it's a question I like to ask, and I forget to do it as regularly as I would like to, but I asked him, so what are you afraid of right now? Like, just in general in life. And he started to tell me about what he's stressed about. And I said, that's not what I asked.
Wow.
Like, what are you afraid of? And I can't even recall what the answer was, not that it's important, but it's like, that's a super hard question to ask,
yeah.
But it's super hard to answer. And I ask that because one of the biggest things that changed my relationship was advice that I received to speak your fears, like to your partner. And it changed the level of vulnerability, at least from my side. I became much more available to my relationship, and I couldn't find balance with the partner that I was with at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't open up as much to me. I felt very safe being open with him, But he couldn't return that, and it was too much. Like, after a while, it became very unfulfilling for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I need vulnerability. Like, I need water. Like, I need a good sexual relationship with somebody. I need them to have vulnerable conversation with me. Like, that's just one of those, like, you say touch. To me, that's part of, like, the vulnerability component.
Well, and the more we talk about all of this, it just becomes so clear why at the very beginning of this conversation you said, yeah, it's more than touch. It's not just touch. It's a whole lot mm-hmm. more, and I wouldn't just call it touch. The speaking your fears thing, what it reminds me of is something that Brené Brown put out recently. And I think she termed it, I can't remember the word she used, but it's sort of like, okay, I'm going to give you this, the best sort of like relationship fix. But what it was when you have fears about things, whatever it is in your relationship, that you come to your partner and you say, okay, this is the story that I'm making up in my head. And you tell them, and that's just another way of expressing your fears.
It's another way of saying it. Yeah, exactly. And it's very non-threatening.
Yeah.
You're acknowledging that it's a story and that it doesn't necessarily hold any truth.
Yes.
And I've put that one into play also.
I do too.
Yeah.
It's great. And not just with partner, with everybody in my life that
no,
I have a connection
with. No, with everyone.
Yeah, the story I'm telling myself right now is that you really don't want to go have dinner with me and that you're really busy because I heard something in your voice. And so you know what's happening here.
Well, yeah, and we're not responding to what's actually happening. We're responding to things that have happened in our past.
Yes.
And those little triggers that go off.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So, yeah, and if you can talk about it with that person and it goes well, then you've just built that foundation that says, like, oh, so this is a real friendship because we're not going to just let uncomfortable isn't going to ruin it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is recovery from uncomfortable. And that's when you start to understand who's, like, really going to show up for you.
It took me a long time to get comfortable with uncomfortable. It took me a long time to, in a relationship, to not see it as, oh my God, we're going to break up. And even though that marriage didn't last, I remember sort of the process that I went through, kind of going, oh, we're going to break up. And then, you know, we'd talk about it and everything would be fine. And finally, I started learning to trust it. And mm-hmm. that was a big deal. That was definitely a big deal.
I'm still working on it, Ruby. I think I tell you that, like, every time we talk, like, it's gotten a lot better. But I still, it's not even my partner's fault. It's just history.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I'd be working on it if I had a partner.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I've become a big fan of Stan Takin. I listen to any, like, podcast I can find with him on it. He wrote a book called Wired for Love, and he talks all about our neurobiology and how, you know, our past triggers things and how we're wired naturally in this, you know, like, survivalist mode. So Stan Takin talks a lot about how a lot of healing has to happen in relationship. I mean, that's what relationship is. And that's been, like, cuts you a little bit of slack because you always hear, like, that you've got to work on yourself and you've got to get yourself right before you get in a relationship. But there's just a lot of stuff you can't even see coming until you get into relationships. And so I feel really fortunate that my partner is all about growth. And obviously I'm about growth. At least I think it's obvious. And he's given me a lot of space to really, he hears a lot of fear come out of my mouth mm-hmm. and a lot of stories come out of my mouth, and he doesn't react to them. And he is unwavering. And I'm the person that's like, is this going to be the end? And he's like, why would it be the end? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, because I'm just waiting for you to say that I'm too much and that you can't deal with me anymore. And thankfully,
so,
he's not like that.
So would you say that he has an ability to differentiate or has an intuition about that? Like, for example, you're going off about something and he kind of can sit back and go, yeah, that's her, but that is not me. You know, this is not about me. This is about something else. Even if he doesn't know what it's about, does he have the skill to kind of know that?
Okay, so here's the interesting thing. I don't go off. Mm-hmm. Like, there's never, I come to him like with a more already thought through process.
Uh-huh.
So we don't have like heated arguments, or it's not like, it's not react, like it's not, there's no flashpoint. There's no,
got it.
So he doesn't find himself in those situations. I've already processed generally a lot of it. And if I haven't finished processing it, he'll say that he knows to just wait and I'll have it worked out. Like,
nice.
He trusts me to do my work. And so, I'll talk to him through the process. But he says that he just waits because he knows, give me 24 hours, 48 hours, and I'll have it figured out.
Mm-hmm.
So he said that many times. So, I mean, he knows, like, we own our own responsibility. Like, we take maybe too much responsibility. We are never blaming other people. Like, we're never blaming each other for stuff that's happened in the relationship. It's always like, well, no, I could have done this better. And then he'll be like, well, no, I could have done this better. Like, it's like the Twilight Zone compared to my marriage before. So we don't have big, like, there's not blow ups that he has to try to figure out where's Michelle coming from.
Trying to figure out that balance of the co-regulation, of taking responsibility for your stuff. I think it's quite natural in so many areas in life to do like the pendulum swing. So for a long time and not be aware of your stuff. And then all of a sudden you are, you just want to own it all.
Yeah.
You just want to, like, okay.
And then you own too much.
Yeah.
And you're not giving your partner responsibility. Like, that's totally, I contemplate this all the time. You know, I drove this relationship for so long. And he didn't have to do a lot of work because I was doing it all, you know, mm-hmm. And it thankfully the pendulum has leveled out a bit and it's not like that anymore. But
that's lovely to hear.
We both had to learn a lot about how to be another Stan Takin, you know, references, like how to be each other's best. How did he put it? Each other's best manager. Like, you need to know how to manage your partner. And I don't say that in a derogatory way.
Or manipulative way.
Right. Understand their triggers. Understand how you can make their life easier and do that for each other. And that it's not bending over backwards and not getting anything in return. If you're doing it for each other to nurture the relationship, then, you know, you both win.
Yeah, I think as long back as maybe it was like that ancient book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, which is like mm-hmm. almost one of the seminal books about the whole difference in how we approach life, but maybe not looking as far as, because it was how men are raised, like is happening now. But it talked about, you have these relationships and, you know, you get into them and it feels really good and it feels safe. And so, you know, you've packed away all this stuff that you haven't dealt with, emotional things that have happened to you in your life, upsets, things that you would normally like take to a therapist to work through if you're the type of person who mm-hmm. goes to a therapist. You get in a relationship and that all-knowing part inside you kind of goes, oh, this is feeling really safe. This is feeling really good. So let's bring this out to deal with. And it may have nothing to do with what's happening right then in your relationship. And it's so easy to project that onto your partner and go, wow, I thought I was in love with this person. Maybe I'm not. And do all kinds of strange things before you recognize that it's something that came from inside you. Some people never recognize that.
Well, I don't think it's that it feels safe. It feels familiar.
Ah, that's a much better word.
Your opportunity. That's your opportunity to work on it. Like, and if you don't work on it, it's going to keep coming up with the next relationship or the next relationship or the next relationship. And we're just looking at a mirror of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I project my mirror onto Paul all the time and I have to catch myself and go, oh no, you're thinking he's afraid in the relationship, but it's really you that's afraid in the relationship. Every time that next escalator move, you know, comes up, I start to panic and I put it on him every time, and I see it now and I catch it really quick. But I've gone down some ugly, nasty rabbit holes with that train of thought mm-hmm. you know, many times.
Well, one of the things that I'm quite heartened to see is this new work that Mark Green is doing. He has a website, and I don't know if he has a website, but he has a Facebook page called Remaking Manhood. And he's Ooh. Written a bunch of articles, and I would put links to all of those in the Linkorama. But he just came out with a new book, and the new book is about how to raise kids so that they don't fall into these traps that we have, you know, just unknowingly, and you do what was done to you and you do what is expected by society. And it's called The Relational Book for Parenting. And it looks like he co-wrote it with a woman named Saliha Bava. And I can't wait to read this, because all of the articles that I've read have been just astonishing in terms of opening up new territory for me in understanding how much we can emotionally handicap men by how they're raised in our society, and why I am seeing some of the things I'm seeing in teaching people about pegging. That's one of the biggest things. So, in fact, you know, every single time I teach a class, I tell the story about having an emotional reaction from G-spot stimulation. And anybody who's heard any of my podcasts practically knows how much of a similarity there is between G-spot and prostate. But what nobody talks about in all the travels that I've done, learning about pegging and readings, other things that people have written, books they've written, they don't talk about that emotional response. It falls into the category, oh, men having emotions? No, let's not talk about that. And I was kind of blown away. When I first started doing a lot of work around this, I thought, what do I have to contribute that no one else has contributed? You know, there's books been written about strap-on stuff. Tristan Taramino, Violet Blue, a bunch of people have written books about pegging. And maybe they didn't use that word because they wrote the book before the word was there, but what do I have that they don't have? And getting in touch with the whole emotional thing is part of what blew my mind. And again, it's connected with all of this stuff. And I've had men tell me that, like, during pegging, they had a moment of feeling the most emotionally open that they've ever felt. In fact, some time ago, there was a guy who, sad story, was sexually abused large part of his younger years. Grew up, got married, told her he'd been sexually abused, but never told her any details. And then Gus started getting into the pegging thing, and he'd listen to my podcast, and he thought, you know, okay, this emotion thing might happen. Who knows, right? And it wasn't like he had this big tearful thing like I did with the G-spot stimulation, and some guys do, some guys don't, but he had a moment of feeling absolutely open and completely vulnerable to another adult, which he'd never had before. Well, of course he hadn't, because of all of that abuse when he was young. And it wasn't like this huge emotional thing where all of a sudden he was in tears, but he was blown away by recognizing that vulnerability. And then the next day on his way to work in the morning, he just spontaneously burst into tears. And that was the beginning of talking with her about what he'd been through in detail and them going to counselors together and stuff. So some of this stuff can be so, it can be such a, what's the word? Catalyst. It can be such a catalyst.
Mm-hmm. But how much bravery, like, I want to think, what does it feel like to never have felt such strong emotion and then to be hit with such a wave of it?
Exactly.
Like, I've had a similar experience. I mean, I tend to shed tears after sex a lot anymore. Mm-hmm. It used to be, it was only during certain kinds of sex. It used to be a joke that, you know, when I was negotiating scenes with people, if I had a fisting scene, I had to negotiate to let my top know that the way that they would know I was done is when I start crying. like it was a regular occurrence for me. And one time during, I think, some digital stimulation, I don't think it went all the way to fisting, but I opened up in a way that scared the shit out of me. And I felt completely exposed. And as somebody who, I'm pretty vulnerable and I'm pretty open, like you said, like I walk around, you know, pretty open. I still, there's always degrees to that. It may appear that I'm very open, but there's always another layer to that onion or that cake, right?
What part of it scared you?
I felt like I couldn't control it.
And
that's what
control,
I generally have is a feeling of some control. I can't control my tears very well, but I control information. And I felt like I didn't have that ability. And I can't even explain how that felt, but that's I felt like I didn't have the ability, although I can't say physically how that felt. Mm-hmm. I remember having conversations with a few other people in my life those next couple of days of just being like really shook by it and having to talk to people about it because it was something I'd never felt before. And I'm an emotional person. So to have that happen and feel so rocked by it, I can't imagine what it's like to never have felt even close to being that open mm-hmm. and having that wide open on you. Like, whoo, talk about life-changing experience.
No kidding. Yeah, there's a guy that I know that was raised in a family that prized themselves on not being emotional, and not just for the men. That's kind of what they did. And it was almost a badge of honor. And mm-hmm. then he grows up and he gets into a couple of different career choices that emphasize that intensely. You know, put all the emotions aside, be the big strong mm-hmm. guy, do the thing. And then discovers that he has this love of panties. And I will never forget, he had panties on and he wore them the whole day. And he and I were texting. And he... Mm-hmm. kind of had a meltdown when he took them off. And I was basically talking him through it. He said, "What the hell is happening to me?" And I said, "It's mm-hmm. okay. You're having emotions. It's okay." He said, "It doesn't feel okay." And I said, "Well, that's because it's not familiar and it can feel scary and it can feel like, you know, it's never going to end. And it might get a little bit worse before it gets better, but it's a good thing." It's a good thing that you're actually feeling this. Mm. He'd never felt anything like that before.
Oh, that's so sexy.
That was not the last word I expected in that sentence.
I know. It's so that awareness and like the permission to feel those things and to feel like the permission to enjoy something that's not society acceptable. Like, all that stuff is so stinking sexy to me. Like, I mean, I'm sure he was going through a whole world of things, and here I'm thinking about myself. But, I guess this is kind of why I like submissive-ish men. Like, I like that going against the grain, kind of. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so normal to be the big domly man, right? Mm-hmm. But, like, a strong man is, to me, a man that is willing to do the thing because he likes it, not because society tells him that that's what he's supposed to do. Like, that's strength. And vulnerability is so sexy to me. Obviously, it's a pillar in what I need in my relationships. Like,
You have reached the end of Pegging Paradise podcast number 200, part 1.